This talk is on the melancholy mind. But I'd just like to preface it with, again, why we're doing this. I feel it's important that we're just not looking at different moods and personality issues, but we're really looking deeply at what drives our life. I was in Kansas City this weekend teaching, and was a non-residential retreat, and at the end of the retreat, a woman came up to me, and she said, gave me a very, very meaningful bit of feedback, and she said, "You make the Dharma very accessible," she said. She said, "For the first time in all the years I've been practicing," and I can't remember how long that was, she says, "I feel that freedom is a possibility." And I, that gladdened my heart. I want all of us to feel that. It's very important for all of us to feel the accessibility of the Dharma. That this isn't something remote, something after 20 years of profound contemplation in the caves of the Himalayan mountains, or after studying the subtleties of the Buddhist scriptures and placing all of the different intricacies back to my mind's condition and working with it infinitely, I can then arrive at some state called freedom. That feels too much to me like one of these mazes that you see in these puzzle books, that you keep finding not the gold box, but the blockage. And for us, or how we're teaching it, to pick up the pencil is the beginning of freedom. You don't even have to go to the maze. And every act that we do and everything we do, there is the implication or the possibility of arriving. And so the reason we're studying this array of mind is because they're with us mostly. And it's because we don't know what to do with them. They often accompany us on the journey of our life, consolidating their moods around our whole life frame of reference, our whole direction and meaning, and pretty soon it's no longer just an emotion we're having, but suddenly the emotion turns to a mood that's prolonged and everlasting, and then the mood turns into an attitude or perception of how we look at life, and the perception, before we even know it, becomes a posture in how we take a stance to life, how we get up out of bed. How are we supposed to come back to any sense of freedom when we carry this burden with us? Unless we see, unless we understand that these moods also carry that immediacy. That if we know how to work with them, if we know how to use them, the spiritual is within them, not around them, not having to fix ourselves in spite of them, but in the midst of them. And so for those of us who are laden with heavy emotions, it's not as if we have to plummet down through the psychological layers of all of our troubled childhood. To transcend these things everlastingly. So I chose the melancholy mind. And maybe I'll talk a little bit about depression, although melancholy doesn't feel as severe as depression. Melancholy is just more of the intonation of sadness that we carry with us. And one of the reasons I chose this particular quality of mind to talk about is because as the heart starts to soften, as we find ourselves more user-friendly, as we begin to genuinely care, I'm using the same, saying the same thing, as our awareness grows, this heart, that which has bound the heart, that which has laced it, caged it, begins to become malleable, permeable. And all of a sudden we begin feeling things we haven't felt. And one of those most common feelings is sadness, is grief. And it's just, we were so, again, we haven't been willing to face the signs of our grief. Or we haven't been willing to soften our heart, partially because the grief is there and we don't want any part of it. So by looking around it or avoiding it, it continues to layer itself upon layer itself over our heart. And so as we come back into this thing and start owning our life and owning all aspects of ourselves, of course, we're going to soften and feel grief. We're going to feel what we've encased the heart in, of course. So sadness is very much a component part of many people's experience as they travel this practice. And as I was thinking about the talk, it's interesting, I was, you know, just in the thinking about the talk, I had some piano music on, very quiet piano music. All of a sudden, it was like George Winston or somebody, and I was, and I was like in this incredible sense of sadness just permeating the room. I said, great, now, here I go. Now I can really explore it. It won't be abstract. Let me look at this thing. But it has. There's a kind of tenderness to it. And I can see how alluring it can be for some people who can carry a sadness in their heart to stay in that and foster it and encourage an identifying link to it, because it is, it's alluring, it's tender. There's a kind of tenderness in this and a nobility, right? Yeah. Sigh. A gentle energy, but it's not unpleasant. As I looked at it, it's not unpleasant, and you can see it's very, it beckons you. You know, because it's kind of like, oh. You can see why people who have tendencies towards that reinforce those tendencies. It's a kind of affirming energy, actually. My life has been hard. You know, it's sort of, but again, I want to just read something in the Dhammapada. Thought manifests as word. Word manifests as deed. Deed develops into habit. Habit hardens into character. So watch the thought in its way with care and let it spring from love. So perhaps early on or something, we've been disappointed in our life. A series of disappointments, and that in itself is nothing special. Every one of us go through disappointments. Disappointments is just a part of life. But if those disappointments come sequentially, rapidly, so that there isn't much room, or more routinely, or if we're starved for an identity, those disappointments can mold themselves into a kind of emotion that becomes our companion. Sadness. And then the sadness, when you're sad, there's a certain way that you see the world. And it's not even seen as a distortion, really. It's seen as this is just what the world's doing to me at the moment. So part of it is in our willingness to hold disappointment, to hold lost expectations, to hold a world that doesn't live up to what we want it to be. And some people get enraged by that, and other people get sad by that. But when that mood turns into a kind of attitude that we live with, and you know it because there's a kind of way that it moves into poor me, into a poor me relationship, self-pity. And if that becomes absolute enough, then melancholy can turn into depression. Now, I'm not going to speak too much about depression tonight because that's more of a clinical picture, and I'm not a clinician, certainly not able to speak about it with any authority. But it seems to me that from sadness to depression is only a step of absolutism. There's a very fine line, perhaps not as severe and not as total of a picture, but in depression there's a hopelessness that comes from sadness and discouragement, which is melancholy, to hopelessness. So there's a cliff somehow that we fall off, in which the world spins down in the funnel, where it may start out as just disappointment, moving to melancholy, but at the bottom of that vortex could well be depression. And I know there's a whole chemical array and disturbance in the mind's chemistry that also leads to depression, so I'm not going to really say too much more about it than that. But we all have periods in which melancholy can turn to depression, even if we're not, even if we have chemically balanced systems. So the melancholy mind looks out from the vantage point and sees what is lacking, what is missing, what is not here. And it fixes itself by the missed opportunities in life. What has been disappointed. And then the expectation from those past disappointments is that life is just going to continue to be disappointing to me. That it's never really going to change around. That it's just going to have this kind of heavy layer. You know, I did a workshop with the staff at a retreat center in Massachusetts, IMS. And it was all afternoon, and we worked on. I had them all lie on the floor, and then I got them, gave them a whole scenario in which they became terminally ill, and then they got right to the edge of their death, and they looked at who was around and what were their regrets and all of that, and then I had them die, and then I had them come back to life, and tell me what the story, what it felt like to die. And not just one, and there were about 15 or 20 people, but the majority of the people said they weren't comfortable in their death because when they died, it was a sense of remorse that it didn't fulfill their expectations. And until they had lived and recovered some of what they really wanted to get out of life, they couldn't die peacefully. seems to me that's what we're talking about tonight. That's not the Dharma. If we find ourselves constantly lamenting and looking backward, like life, like we were driving a car and looking through the rearview mirror, so that our life becomes more pronounced by the missed opportunities than what's exactly manifesting now, that's a sign, that's a key, that's a cue that we are falling into the traps of the mood. It's only a mood that can carry that kind of vantage, that kind of perspective. But many of us do that. Many of us define our life by what has not happened. I never had a child. I always wanted to be an artist. On and on it goes, so that what is actually manifesting can't have the creative spirit, because the energy is being drained by what has not occurred. So there's no sense of vitality in the moment, because the moment is being depleted by past remorse. But when we come together like this, what we come together above all else is to affirm the moment. To affirm it. That herein lies completion. Not in waiting for another lifetime in which you can have a child or the right relationship, or to be selected by the major leagues. As someone was telling me, when he turned 40, he realized he wasn't going to be drafted into the NFL. So what is it here that allows a contentment to take place that doesn't deny how one's life has been, but doesn't constantly make it a placeholder, make it a stand on which one's ability to die rests? How can I die? You know, what's keeping us from being able to die now? And you'll see how much your life rests on what you haven't done. If you were to think, if I were dying today, and fill that in, therein is the burden of time and the shadow of melancholy. Which defies everything of importance. So, I listen for what's important. I'm not going to let my mind turn me back. I'm not going to turn around. Which means I have to go through the remorse and sadness of not having lived up to my own and other people's expectations. It's okay. So what? In this way, I recover my vitality despite all the limited opportunities and missed chances that I have lived. Despite that, my life can be totally complete, totally fulfilling. Really, it's a kind of way we keep ourselves in non-forgiveness. You know, it really has something to do with that. How we won't allow ourselves to move forward . So some people who do get pulled down by the melancholy mind, and then sometimes it turns into depression and it starts to really move into the cycles of depression, legitimately take some medication because the medication allows them to come back up and see from a level playing field. And I support people who do that. Oftentimes, meditators feel remiss. I had one friend, and she said she was on Zoloft, I think it was. And then she said, you know, I feel like I'm being remiss. And here's what she... I even wrote it down, so... This isn't really me. I'm the tired and cranky one from a couple of weeks ago, she said. This isn't really me. You see how strong the identification was around the melancholy? This isn't really me. I think I should stop taking Zoloft and go back and feel the cranky, irritable, sad person. And then if I really had it together, I would figure out why I was so cranky and miserable and work myself up from that. But I've kind of cheated. I haven't worked myself up. So I want to go into this question of working on our problems. I'm going to go right into this sucker. Because we need this. As we begin to look at these different qualities of mind and the self-pitying that goes along with it and the sense of how they hold me in place and the endless rounds of therapeutic environments we seek, and we never think, you know, that we're always just going down and we haven't gotten really down to the bottom of it yet, you know, as if there's some bottom to it. And the deeper we go, the more ensconced in it we become. So I'm going to dig a little bit. Now, when I do, I also want to hold a great deal of respect for people who work therapeutically. I'm not talking down about therapy. Let's understand this. Most problems were generated in relationship, and through relationship you have access to most problems. That makes sense, does it not? But now we're not talking about a good, clear, honest relationship of therapy to client. We're talking about an internal response to my problems and how I have to dig them out, how I have to keep going down. So we're going to go into that. So when we look at what we feel like when we're depressed or melancholy, we feel like that mood holds a statement about us. This is what identity is. Now, okay, so that's already a sign that we've gone astray. Because nothing in your mind and body experience ever holds a statement about you, no matter how frequently it arrives. Nothing. It's complete insanity, said the Buddha, to ever say, I am this way. Now I should just end the talk there. So we look for the meaning of ourselves within the mood. And we do this by creating more analysis of the mood, more words, more thoughts, never realizing, an important point, that the words themselves are the problems. The words themselves spawn the problem. And we can never find our way out of a problem using words. Because there is nothing that won't pass and come and go in its own time. But the words capture it and claim reference to it, an identity with it, and then create a kind of symmetry of sound inwardly, so that it starts coming out of the mood itself, generating a deeper and darker and more vacuous whirlpool. So it's the sadness, oh, you know, and then you just start, your whole conversation comes from that, and the sadness spins off, creating the reasons for me being sad, and that creates, amplifies the feeling of sadness because the words create and capture the emotion within them, and then it just keeps going. And then through analysis, of course I'm so sad because I had parents and I had this and I had that happen, and all justification for feeling this. If we'd stop the words, what would there be? We think that the words allow us some vantage point, some sense of clarity. So what really they're doing is just sucking us down into the vortex. Now that's the truth. That is absolutely the truth. And when you see it, you're done with them. You're done with them. And we think that the problem we have, there must be some hidden reason why we're having this problem, and down we go. So the problem is contained within further thought about it. When we go more deeply into moods, one of two things happens. There can be, it can lead to more honesty and humility and more strength of character to examine one's emotions through therapy or other ways. It's legitimate. Or we can confirm our worst case scenario that we think there's something rotten in the state of Denmark. So the question is, do we need to go deeply and wallow in the emotion in order to heal from it? Going deeply often means admitting that there is an awful person the emotion seems to imply. And that's self-blame. So now the mood comes from self-blame. You see, this is so tricky. And as long as there's a sense of me-ness in the whole thing, it just keeps getting back and forth like badminton, where the mood starts off and then there's a blame of self for having the mood, and I have to go deeper, and then I find some legitimate causes for sadness in my life, and that's the reason. And then it just keeps... You feel that? Feel the insanity of it. Feel the insanity of it. So we're looking for some heavy news about the sense of me, rather than letting it be. Rather than just letting it be. Spiritual work should lead progressively to the unknown, not to the determined. Let us understand that. If it's giving you conclusions, summing up your life, that's where psychology and spirituality split. In Buddhism and spiritual work, the content of the mental stream is not as important as the awareness that holds it. And bare attention softens the impact of the personal stake we have in each and every aspect of ourselves. When we hold something in awareness, just bear attention. We're no longer confirming the whirlpool of our thought, spinning us down deeper. And problems and solutions both have relevance, equal relevance. And we learn to be able to rest in ambiguity. By not summing up the equation with an I equivalent. This shows that I am. Why? Because nothing has any fixed relationship in essence. The stream freezes for a while, and then we can always thaw it by letting it be. It freezes with our assertion that I am the responsible party. And it begins flowing again with our willingness to let it be. So get a sense of this being radical therapy. There are times and occasions when people have to talk about their past. And to explore those emotions together. But have some spiritual sophistication along with that accompanying journey so that it isn't an ever-ending journey into this bleakness. This is buoyancy. We float to the surface in this work. There's absolutely nothing in essence. Now, so this is an absolute statement. There is absolutely nothing you need to work out. Now, that is the absolute truth. And then skillful means comes in, therapy being one of those skillful means, because we cannot open to that level of truth. We're too afraid of it. We're too afraid of giving up all of the identification that we've had with all of the mind states like sadness. We're too afraid of that. We don't know what's on, so we have to go into this working out phase. Only to discover, if we're honest, that it has been a journey to nowhere. We feel we should be a person without problems, never realizing where problems arise, how problems arise. They don't arise from an entity who has gone astray, because there isn't one. But we will make it one by our determination to resolve the problem. Let it be. Does this mean that I can forget all about my moods? Not on your life. We forget about nothing in this. We go to every aspect of our reality. Right? They are part of our aliveness. We have to be totally with them. And what we begin to realize, again, I'm not giving you all the skillful means that I honor, because I want you to get the point. And so don't come to me and say, you mean I shouldn't be in therapy? Yes, if you feel like you should be in therapy, be in therapy. But I want you to hear I don't want you to see it always as a goal or a... Okay, so... when I'm sad, that's it. It means nothing. It has no context. It's the arising, like the arising of everything else. I don't have to assume a stance or a posture in it. That's an excusing it. What I'm really afraid of in my sadness is that I'll be overwhelmed with the grief. But how can we be overwhelmed with the grief when all there is grief in that moment? There's no me outside of the grief that could be overwhelmed. If we're willing to release our tension with the grief, we will know that to be the fact, and emptiness will be there for us. Truth. It's the resistance to the fact that creates the sense of me having to get over this thing. And I do that tension, I create that tension with the words I tell myself about it. So I have a problem. Here I have sadness. Of course you have a problem. As soon as you say that, you have the problem. Now I've got to go into the sadness and work it out, and foster this sense of me working out my salvation. So I, you see, and all along the line, my words are just reconfirming my resistance to the thing itself. So what do? Nothing. That's what I do. I do nothing in the true sense of that. I don't excuse it, blame it, hold on to it, analyze it. I don't do this either. Well, this will pass. Nietzsche, it'll go. Things change. Things will change. Things will change. This is good territory we're going into tonight. I just want to make sure that people feel validated in whatever journey they're on into this territory. But I have to give you the extreme so that you can work your way out of the forest sometimes. It's okay. When there is absolutely no resistance to the sadness, there's no context for the sadness to be known. I only know the sadness in context to not being sad, which is a memory that reaffirms me now being sad. You see it? Which means I have to let go of all resistance to it, which means there's nothing in the world but that. And the moment that's crossed, it all opens. Because at that moment, there's no more thought perpetuating it. I've gone long beyond thought now. There's just presence. And therein I rest. And therein the Dharma is accessible to us all. And therein the heart is in full delight. Can we sit for a minute or two?